What is up, all of you beautiful listeners out there? Parsa here, and today's guest is my dear friend, Maya Ellinger. Maya is a writer, director, and freelance journalist based out of Atlanta, and she is the co-founder of both Film Pitch ATL and Atlanta Micro Theater. I don't want to spoil this episode by going too much into detail about what Film Pitch and Micro Theater are, but suffice it to say that Maya is an exceedingly talented person, both in writing and in directing and in creating opportunity for people in our city to interact with film and with theater and with good storytelling. She's a storyteller through and through. We talk about her coming to Atlanta from Southern California, her upbringing in a very creative family, her opportunity to explore writing both fiction and nonfiction throughout her life and to hone her skills as a writer and her passions as a writer. We talk about traveling. We talk about a little bit about politics, not really too much, to be honest, because that's a long, winding rabbit hole that we could get down. But it was an awesome, awesome conversation, and I'm sure you're going to like it. You can find more about Maya out at the end of this episode. We're going to do some plugs for Film Pitch ATL as well as Atlanta Micro Theater. But the next Film Pitch is going to be on Wednesday, August 28th. Just wanted to go ahead and put that out there before we start this episode, just in case you don't have time to make it all the way to the end. But you should come out August 28th, which is a Wednesday, to Film Pitch ATL. Just look up Film Pitch ATL online and you will find it. And without further ado, here is a fantastic conversation with Miss Maya Ellinger.
At any given moment, we know what the world is feeling.
Are you wearing pajama pants to school? Why, yes, I am.
I was, in a way, elevating him. I was celebrating him.
We wanted to build a beer pong table.
No, it's the Show ATL podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Show ATL podcast, the podcast where we seek to find and highlight Atlanta's creative voice. Today we are sitting with a good friend of mine, the lovely Maya Ellinger. Welcome.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, thank you. We've been trying to set this up for a while, and we've been touching base a lot over the last like year, it feels like, in the U.S. and abroad and kind of everywhere in between, but really happy to have you here.
Thanks. I know this is, it's been a while in the works, but it's exciting and I'm really looking forward to joining the Show ATL kind of community.
Yeah, welcome. We've had some amazing guests, some not so great guests, just kidding. All the guests are fantastic, but it's an honor to have you here, mainly because you're a friend of mine, and it's a privilege always to talk to friends as opposed to talking to people who I've not had a lot of rapport with. Granted, all conversations here are pretty awesome, but it's really cool having a friend sitting across and having a little chat.
We can have our true chats.
No, it's awesome. But you just came off of a great weekend, which is a lot of kind of what we're hoping to talk about today, along with a lot of other stuff, because you are a multifaceted, very talented individual. But this weekend was a big one for you.
Yes, yes, absolutely. This weekend was a really cool opportunity for me as a creative and as someone who cares deeply about the Atlanta creative business community. So we did our first inaugural opening, I guess, or just our grand opening of the Atlanta Micro Theater. Now, when you hear micro theater, people are like, what are you talking about?
Right,
what
right.
is happening? So just to kind of give everyone an overview of what micro theater is. Micro theater is a concept that theater does not have to be digested in grand ballrooms or theaters or any sort of like grand production. Mm-hmm. The idea is art and culture is accessible to everybody and can be done anywhere. So we put together a small, intimate performance of two plays that were 15 minutes in length, performed throughout the night. So people could come see 15 minutes of an original play written by Atlanta writers, with Atlanta directors, and with all Atlanta/Georgia talent.
Okay. So this was on Saturday, which
yes.
Today is what, Tuesday the 30th?
Tuesday the 30th, yeah.
Yeah, and this was Saturday the 26th? 8th?
When did we do it? Two weekends ago.
Oh, it was 2 weekends
yes,
ago.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, which is fine.
And I've just been riding on this, like, you did this last weekend thing. Congratulations. But no, I'm
flying past. Yes. Yeah, so it was 2 weekends ago officially.
Okay.
Middle of July.
Foot officially in mouth pretty early on my end, but that's okay.
No. And I was like, it must have been last weekend because I'm still like exhausted from it.
So 2 weekends ago, you guys did the first run of micro theater, which you've just described in brief, but where was it? And tell me about essentially what the night was like for you, because, and I'm going to get into the backstory of it a little bit later, but you've been working incredibly hard on this along with a few other things, but it's all kind of come to this, you know, project that you've been spending a lot of time on. So what was opening night like? Yeah. Describe, I guess, the environment, the plays, the setup, the space, right? Because it is a little bit different based on the conversations we've had from, you know, a traditional sit down, watch a production, right? So instead of like botching it by trying to describe it on my end, you tell me what was the evening like for you?
Yes. Yeah, so the entire experience was, yes, like you said, very different than quote unquote traditional theater. We performed this on the Beltline on the bottom of the Telephone Factory lofts, if people are familiar. It's an abandoned area, right now that is, I guess, called Generator. It will eventually be built out, but right now it's a series of just very abandoned rooms.
Okay.
And like any creative, when you see something where you're like, abandoned and this is weird, we're like, cool, what can we do here that's cool and creative and get people into the space? And so, yes, there's a long backstory into how we got this idea going. But for that day, what we did, you know, we had about a week to find our cast, rehearse, get everyone together, which if anyone has done live theater, is not a lot of time to have actors prep.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it.
But it came together well. So I wrote a play in this, and I also directed it. So it was an exciting opportunity to work with actors and help them kind of see my vision of what I wanted it to look like. So the night started, we did five plays.
Okay.
They showed my play five times. So people would come off the Beltline, or they had bought tickets, depending, and would come off the Beltline, join us, sit down on truly fold-out chairs that we had found in the back of the Telephone Factory lofts, and saw a 15-minute play, original play, one-act play, really. And, you know, to kind of set the scene, my play took place in a speakeasy.
Mm-hmm.
So everything in there was borrowed from friends, we found little knickknacks that were like, would this be in a bar? Sure, let's put it on.
So you had a full set with props and everything.
Full set,
okay.
Full props that we really found, got donated to us. I brought from my house. I mean, the day of, I was literally like, my parents were in town and they were like lugging boxes of things to the apartment. We were like going to Home Depot. So it was very much a labor of love in that way. Because. And it worked out better, I think, than having like a full, we didn't have a set designer or anything. We just said, this is 15 minutes. We want it to feel like people are immersed in this 15 minutes of theater. So the room was set up as if when you were an audience member, you walked in and you felt like you were sitting at a bar and the play was happening.
Is this does this originate from somewhere, this style of theater, this like immersive theater, or is this something that you just came up with, or you guys came up with for Atlanta Micro Theater? I haven't seen a lot of theater. I'm going to be fairly honest. I've seen some great theater, the theater that I've seen, but have not been an attendee for a lot of smaller productions generally. Yeah. Right. So is this, describe this style of theater. Is this new, or how did you come upon this?
Yeah. So originally this idea, from what we've researched, I believe started in Spain, but the one that piqued my interest that I was like, this is cool, Atlanta needs something like this, is the Miami Micro Theater. And okay. What they do is, it's not as immersive, but they actually perform in shipping containers. And so they have shipping containers lined up, and you walk into the shipping container, see a short play, and move on with your evening. I was so in love with that idea when I heard it. I was like, that is great. That is accessible art and culture.
Right.
What can we do here? And for us, it was, okay, where can we find foot traffic? The Beltline.
Mm-hmm.
Where can we find a space on the Beltline? Okay, let's turn this into a theater. So it was really seeing the space, seeing it kind of disheveled, not really put together. I mean, there were, you know, wires hanging and
right,
things. And
we thought,
what play could I put on here that would make sense? So it was a little bit of saying, okay, we have this idea, but what story can I tell in this space, in this limited amount of time?
So this space, for people who don't know where the Telephone Factory lofts are, it's just off the Beltline by Ralph McGill Boulevard, pretty close to Two Urban Lakes. It's a very like industrial looking space.
Yes.
So it's perfect for it's very malleable. You can turn it into whatever you will. It's like a perfect theater space. Did you guys, you mentioned figuring out how to adapt the space, but were you looking for something that was kind of raw and bare, like this generator space?
You know, initially that wasn't the goal,
okay,
but I'm so glad that that's where we ended up going with, because we really could, it was a blank canvas.
We could say
what play would make sense here with, you know, a limited space. You know, we could only fit 25 people in each show.
Oh, really?
So okay. Saying, okay, what are we going to do with 25 people in a room?
Right.
And what story can we tell in 15 minutes, which is not a lot of time
to tell
an entire story.
Right. So this was one scene pretty much?
Yes, it was one act play really. And we performed the same play throughout the night. So the audience shifted.
Right.
But what was cool about that too, and I'm not an actor, I definitely will never be an actor, but what I found is that the actors that were in my play appreciated it because they got to immediately make adjustments.
Mm.
So they did one performance and then they got to do it again.
Right.
And change lines, kind of say, hey, let's improv this part a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's have a little bit more fun with it. Which in quote unquote traditional theater, you'd have to wait till the next day.
Right. Yeah.
This was like more immediate feedback.
Yeah, which is great because it's very fresh and I think the audience hopefully can sense that when they come and see the play that the actors are, I guess, enjoying the scene. They're engaging. They're lively. I would hope.
Yes. It was so great too. Because when I wrote the play, I wanted it to be very much about the place. I'm very big on place and space.
Right,
and so
right.
When I wrote the play, I knew that it was set in Atlanta and I wanted it to feel like a true Atlanta production. And so that was anything from the jokes that they said to kind of the feeling of the entire space and it all. But to see it evolve to where, you know, all four of my actors live here in the Atlanta area.
Mm-hmm.
And they became so part of the, they really helped collaborate in saying like, okay, well, what if we changed this part and, you know, threw in this joke
right.
that was very much an insider Atlanta joke. So, which was fun. I think with micro theater, it gave us the ability to get really granular
mm-hmm.
in a way that if we had to sell tickets to, you know, 400, 500 people, I don't know, it would have had the same feel.
I get that. I do get that. Yeah. It's very, I mean, you're hyper-locating really as much as you possibly can, because you're coming right in the heart of what I would consider what is happening in Atlanta now, right? I mean, you are at an intersection really where you have the opportunity to kind of push a little bit. Even if someone's not from Atlanta, you have that, I guess, authority to say, well, this is Atlanta, bitch. Like, this is...
Right. You're this, here.
You're here. You're in the heart of it. You're probably... Maybe you don't live, like, in the immediate vicinity of the Beltline. Unlikely that you do, right? Like, who really does?
Right.
But it's like, you know, you're going to sit here and you're going to consume what is homebred, homegrown Atlanta theater, which is super cool.
So, yeah. And that was really the cool part, is people really walking up the Beltline, because we had cryptic signs that said, Atlanta Micro Theater this way. And shockingly, people walked up and were like, what does this mean?
I think that's a great way to do it.
And
right?
Yeah, and I wanted my play to really reflect that you're coming in and you're taking on a show that is based here in Atlanta on the Beltline. This is a scene that is meant to be performed here and really nowhere else.
Yeah, so I guess let's talk about moving forward. But first, I got to talk about you. Right.
Okay.
Because you're a fascinating person in that you are extremely creative, and coming into theater is somewhat new for you.
Yes. Yeah? Barring a short stint in high school performing Shakespeare, this is really my like first theater play, anything. So
okay.
Yes.
So you,
very new.
So you are a writer, a director, a freelance journalist.
Yes.
So always have been creating and storytelling and I guess creating worlds and creating stories and people and things like that. So that concept at all is not new to you, right? That's your home turf. But adapting it for a play was something new for you. So I guess getting into that, tell me about your background generally as a writer and a journalist, right? Because you're not originally from Atlanta. You're from Southern California.
Correct.
Okay. And you'd mentioned in, you know, before this that your family is very creative. So you were brought up in a home that encouraged storytelling and creativity. So tell me about what drew you, I guess, to writing, to journalism, to creativity.
Yeah, absolutely. I lovingly refer to myself as a displaced Californian, because I was born and raised there 18 years and moved to Atlanta for college and have never really looked back. But yes, I was born and raised in Southern California.
And you went to Emory.
And yeah. I went to Emory, yes. Nice. So Emory pulled me out here, which was the best decision ever to get me out of California.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was really fortunate that I grew up in a family that really admired the arts, supported the arts, and that came in many different forms. You know, kind of traditionally, my mom's a filmmaker, and so I grew up...
Which is super cool.
So she's amazing. And yeah, so she always encouraged me to write and you know, kind of read everything out there, watch everything out there, because she's, you know, one of those true filmmaker creatives.
Right.
And so I had that perspective. And then my dad, you know, is still one of these like wonderful artists. He is, you know, an engineer, mm-hmm. which can be creative.
Yeah, I can.
But, you know, he spends every, you know, moment that he has free time singing, or he's in several like symphonies and does lots of chamber music and all of that.
That's insane. So he's a by day engineer.
And by night, singing,
performance, music.
Exactly. He's,
it's like Clark Kent and Superman.
It is a little bit. Yes.
Yeah.
And so, he, you know, always so encouraged, you know, music and the arts and always has been a huge fan of me wanting to be a writer, which I feel like is not the case for a lot of people.
Totally.
That
it's very unique.
It is. And yeah. I really appreciate that, that from a very early age, it was, you know, write poetry, you know, try a screenplay, write a song. And that was so encouraged mm-hmm. Throughout. And so I knew, gosh, like I knew from like third grade on, I wanted to be a writer. I just didn't know what sort of writer I wanted to
be. So that early. So it's been that's been with you for most of your life.
Oh, yes. I knew from a very early age. I mean, I remember, you know, writing poetry and being like, this is the only thing I want to do for the rest of my life.
Really?
I'm in love with this.
Well, that's fantastic. I feel like a lot of kids are not like that at all, just because we're exposed, I guess, to so much academically and socially growing up that I personally probably bounce back and forth between 20 different career options before I even got to high school. But this was something it must have resonated profoundly with you.
Oh, yes. I knew immediately, pretty much immediately, like that was my goal.
That's wild.
But for me, the path that was different was that when you say you want to be a writer, there's so many different ways that can manifest itself. And so, you know, throughout high school and college, I had the opportunity to work on documentaries, and I was able to create my own film and video content that I absolutely loved to do that. And I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to kind of follow my mom's footsteps and be a filmmaker, because that's awesome writing. But then in college, I started writing for magazines and newspapers around, and I thought, wait, I really like nonfiction writing and interviewing people and telling this story from a journalistic perspective.
Okay.
You know, and it's manifested in it sounds a little bit like I have creative ADD or writing ADD, which is probably very true. But for me, it's always been, I want to be a writer, but I need to figure out and I need to explore all the different platforms and avenues in which that story can be told. So whether it's on the screen or on paper, what does that look like and how does that story need to be told?
Right, right. So were you initially, you mentioned starting to do poetry and creative writing and things like that. What drew you to nonfiction, I guess? And is that mainly kind of your focus now outside of writing screenplays and
dabbling in micro theater.
Dabbling in theater and all these things.
Yes, yes. My focus now has really turned to nonfiction. And I think that came across, that came about in a couple of different ways. I found myself in college really passionate. I think a lot of college students, you know, when you start, when your world opens up and you hear what's going on outside of your small suburban home,
right,
and you think, oh, wow. Everything, you know, you want to learn everything. You want to fight every injustice. And for me, I thought, okay, I can use my writing to do that. So I got to, you know, work on a documentary in Haiti, and I got to write stories about public health crises around the world with like Emory's Global Health Department. And that for me was this eye-opening experience of saying, okay, writing doesn't just have to be fiction,
right,
which is great.
Right.
I mean, I love sitting there and just, you know, doing a character sketch on someone and saying like, this will be fun.
Yeah.
Who could this character be? What world can I build? But I found myself really being drawn to more journalistic endeavors because I felt like I could explore and talk to some really interesting people.
Mm.
And sometimes real stories are more interesting than anything that you could make up.
I totally agree. I think it takes a very special talent to take the ordinary and take the real and turn it into something magical. Because, I don't know, I think that we lose ourselves in fiction as somewhat of an escape, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, fiction is ultimately a way to kind of enter into another world outside of our own. But nonfiction writing, if done well, makes our own world that much better and enhanced and worth engaging with.
Oh yeah. I mean, when you think, and you know, I did end up majoring in history,
mm-hmm,
which, is a little, it makes sense for a writer. But you know, when you read wonderful historical books, historical nonfiction books, you know, you can really become engrossed and realize, wow, if this is biography, I'm reading about someone, if this is, you know, even understanding just the way a war unfolded or whatever it is, it's a magical experience to say, this is our real world and real people lived this. And it's, and it can just be a really beautiful and eye-opening experience.
it's, well, I do not want to get political on this show. It's not my thing, but, and it just, I find that it just opens a can of worms that,
fair,
that
yes.
no one really wants to go down. But I find it fascinating that people can look at historical nonfiction and somehow disassociate themselves from the realities of the present or of the future, to think that something was the way it was and can no longer be that way, when the reality is that I think that history is very cyclical.
Oh, yes.
And I think there's much to be gained from understanding historical nonfiction, whereas people, I don't know why they look at it almost through this, you know, distant nostalgia, maybe, as opposed to being able to relate it to modern day, which is, right. I'm leading to, in a certain direction, right? But I don't necessarily want to explicitly go there, but...
No, sure. And I think you hit the nail on the head, because history, we use it as a distancing factor, when really it should be a lens for exploring, you know, helping us understand empathy and sympathy and just really understanding the human condition today.
Right.
And where we come from. And yet we tend to forget those lessons. And now you can learn empathy and sympathy from fiction. And that's important too. But, I just find that the stories that I wanted to tell were of real people.
Right.
And the amazing things that they're doing or did do.
Right. Right. Are you a student of history still, or are you more engaged, I guess, in other avenues of current affairs and politics or whatever?
Sure. I mean, anyone who's interested in history, I think, is naturally interested in political science and kind of current events.
Right.
For sure. You know, I will pick up any good, you know, biography, because that's kind of my go-to book if I just want to curl up and read a good, you know, presidential biography. That's
what's a good recommendation for a good biography?
Okay, so this is a slightly different approach to a biography. I mean, of course, you know, I would have to like recommend anything by Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Okay,
you can just pick up anything and it would be great. But right now, people will laugh who know me, but I have this book on my shelf that I'm reading, and it is a collection of Harry Truman's love letters.
Okay.
And it's decades of him writing and it to his wife. And it's a really interesting way to look at someone's life and look at someone who had an incredibly difficult presidency.
Right.
And, you know, not to get too far into the weeds of history, but...
We can get into the weeds of whatever you think. This is, you're the guest. The show's about you.
And for me, that was such a unique, or it is, I'm in the process of reading it, this interesting new way of thinking about history, of saying like, this is not their official presidential letters. This is not their speeches and whatever. This is their real life.
Yeah.
Writing to their, you know, their sweetheart and things like that.
It humanizes
people.
You know, it's, we tend to disassociate the humanity of all of these public figures throughout history from the events that occurred in their lifetimes or are, you know, accredited to them, right? And I think it's a huge missing piece of the way we read about history,
right,
is the humanity of the people behind them, because that helps us to better understand our own humanity today and how we interact with our,
and what decisions we've made,
right,
or they made.
Yeah. So. No, I love that. I think that's a really refreshing take on anybody's life, to read through the perspective of not just, you know, pure objective events and,
right,
and, you know, cause and response, but the actual heart of a person.
Because history is not a timeline in the same way, you know, any story you want to tell. If you're telling it linearly on a timeline, people are going to be asleep in a second. So.
Oh, totally. We want to hear about, you know, people's shit, right?
Yeah, because we're dealing
with shit, right? It's like, I don't want to, you know, hear about all of these amazing things that this person did while informative. Like, then you have to reflect and be like, well, shit, like, yeah, now what? What do I do with this?
Right. How does this relate to a circumstance that I'm going through, or that, my community is going through.
Right.
You know, however big or small you want to take that question, you really can go with it.
I mean, so, okay. So love to read biographies. You got into nonfiction writing to understand better the world around you. And that was, you know, compounded and grown through your experience at Emory, which is invaluable. I think that as an institution, Emory is, I mean, it just gives you so many opportunities to connect with your world in more meaningful ways, which is super cool that you got that opportunity.
Absolutely. I was really, really fortunate to be able, to have that opportunity, to have, you know, professors who support me, parents, obviously, who made that happen. But yes, it was really having, right now there's a lot of debate about, like, is liberal arts worth it? All of these different things.
Yeah.
But which is a whole topic you can get into. But to have that opportunity to think about things in an interdisciplinary lens and kind of view things, I think that's really why I found myself taking my writing in many different directions, because that was open to me there.
You had mentioned in some stuff that you sent over to me that you fell in love with this intersection of data and communication in the way you write and the way you think and wanting to tell stories in that way, at the intersection of data and communication. What does that mean?
Yeah.
And what does it mean to you? Why is that significant?
Yeah, I would say the last kind of, if I think about all of the writing that I love to do, the last little branch of it that has become my niche recently is data journalism. It's what I went back to school for.
Mm-hmm.
And when people hear that, they think, oh, you know, the first question is, what is data journalism?
Right.
You know, the quick answer is that data journalism is anything that is data-driven reporting. So whether you've got a spreadsheet, you've analyzed it, and you're reporting out numbers on a, you know, whatever FEMA has recently said, or whatever financial disclosure,
mm-hmm.
almost standard investigative reporting in a way. The other part of data journalism is visualizing data, getting people to care.
Right.
Shockingly, people don't give a shit a lot about the news. But if you can visualize a story in an interesting way, that kind of piques people's interest.
I would rephrase that to say people don't care about relevant and important news.
Right.
Right? People care about kind of this fanatical, you know, hyper-sensational news for that very reason, because it is reframed to entertain, to shock, to incite fear, to incite
a clickbait headline. And
exactly.
You think,
yeah.
Oh, that's the news. That's what people are talking about.
Right. But that's exactly the piece of it. It's just people talking. That's
right.
All it is.
It's
all of these, like,
internet
clickbait.
Noise.
Yeah, internet. I would even point to any sort of, like, mass, you know, the CNNs, the Fox Newses of the world, you know, at all, right? Not just those two organizations, but a lot of it is ultimately just people talking. And as objective as any of them try to be, there's always the bias of this is being filtered through one person or one organization's perspective, right? And that's why I think that what we're talking about now with proper investigative journalism and proper data-driven journalism, a lot of that is being, I wouldn't say it's being shoved aside, but it's there's not a focus on it in our culture as a whole.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not just our culture. I was just overseas, and it's very sensational kind of everywhere, right?
Right.
I mean, you look at Brexit right now
Anywhere
in the UK
in Europe.
And Boris Johnson just becoming prime minister, which is an absolute shame, but it seems to be worse here.
Oh, sure.
It seems to be a deliberate kind of negating of fact.
And absolutely. And, you know, when I think about why I kind of took this pivot and said, okay, where can I get, you know, how did I end up at this intersection, is really about that. When I was starting my career, you know, in college and right after college, I was, you know, a freelance journalist.
Mm-hmm.
So you write what people tell you to write,
yep.
or you pitch stories that you're like, someone cares, someone pay me for this, which is a whole interesting hustle. But I realized And this was, you know, again, not to be political, but this was at the time that things were really changing in politics, and the idea of in what was changing in popular culture and mass media. Mm. And you could see, you know, dribbles of it leading up to 2016.
Right.
This whole, you know, manifestation of fake news and all of this. And, you know, I remember I was truly a nobody journalist and trying to interview someone and them calling me a liberal elite. And I was like, I'm doing a story on Piedmont Park. Like, right. This is nothing to do with anything political. And the more I went down and realized, you know, started writing more and doing more journalism, the more I realized if I wanted to make facts matter, if mm-hmm. I wanted to convince people, not that that's the right word, but if right. I wanted to get people to care, I had to do my homework and I needed to understand kind of these new rules of engagement really for communication. I needed to understand how, you know, how do we get data? How do we communicate data? How do we deal with this plethora of everything on the internet?
Yeah.
And so that kind of made me say, you know what? Data is just another tool for a storyteller to use. You can use data to come up with a new, interesting storyline in a film. And can, you know, one data point can be this, you know, the spark that launches your next documentary. And you can right. say, this is the statistic I want to follow. Of course, if you're a journalist saying, okay, these are the facts, the verified facts, if you will.
Right.
Yeah. How do I tell a compelling story that gets people to care? So really, people will raise their eyebrows and say, how did someone from liberal arts get into data?
Mm-hmm.
I see data as just another tool for storytellers to use.
Yeah.
And one that's so important in the digital age.
I agree.
You need it. Doesn't matter what you're, if you're a coder, if you're a data scientist, if you're a writer, you need to be able to, you need to be fluent in the internet and you know, how to use and how to interpret everything on the web.
Yeah, how to filter the crap out, right?
Oh, yes.
I mean, which is, you know, and, you know, by and large, why we see ourselves where we are today. It's because there's this huge older generation of kind of late adopting internet and social media users
yep.
who will believe whatever garbage is thrown at them
oh.
and are very easily kind of manipulated through data, right?
Oh, so, very much.
So there's very much so this, you know, the light side and the dark side of the force when it comes to data, and you're fighting for the right side, it seems, but
I hope so.
Yeah, you are. No, I think you are. I think most people would agree that you are, but I'm going to poke a little bit here
yeah.
and I'm not trying to, like, you know, I'm not trying to get you to say anything damning or condemning, but how much leeway do you think a writer has in interpretation of fact? Even when you're looking at data, when you're looking at empirical verified data, but you're still trying to tell a story.
Right.
To what extent, I guess, what is the elasticity of how you can tell the story around that data? Can you put in, I mean, not to say that you're writing an opinion piece, but can you put in any opinion at all to a data-driven piece, do you think, or does that compromise the journalistic integrity of what you're reporting on?
You know, when it comes to, you know, there's so many different versions of journalism, if you will. There are people that just write op-ed and opinion
right.
pieces. There are people that, you know, go out to write critiques of things. For me, when I think about data journalism, I think you would start that statement by saying, no, there's very little room for, you know, ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing is framing that, because, you know, climate change, yes, a theoretically political topic. We as a data journalist, you have the list of verified facts. You have these data points. How you present that can be really grand. You know, there's amazing visualizations about what is Miami really going to look like in a
right.
couple of years?
Right.
What are these coastlines? And building these models based on data And I think that's where you let your creativity fly.
Mm.
But you say, these are the facts and this is what we stand with. These are verified. And you go from there. I think, you know, there's, of course, as a, when you're dealing with the, and it's, yes, the current political climate, but in general, when you, it gets, the nice thing about data journalism, I will say, is that you get to have a little bit more of a true starting point to say, this is what we should report on. This is where the center of the story is. Sometimes when you're reporting on people, there's emotion, there's misinterpretation of words. Not that there can't be misinterpretation with data. There definitely can be. But it's so much easier.
I agree.
To do that when you take a sound bite.
Oh yeah. But I mean, that's our world now is distillates of sound bites, you know, there to just cause reaction and stir the pot. But
oh, yeah.
What do you say, and not to, you know, totally harp on this topic this much, but what do you say to people who look at something that has been written with journalistic integrity that uses verified data with very little fluff, you would say, around that data, and just says, I don't believe that. Someone who says, I don't believe in climate change, as if it's some sort of ethos that you can subscribe to. It is, it's a verified reality, but they look at the facts and they say, I don't believe that. What do you say to someone like that? Do you say anything? Is it even worth fighting that?
Right. And I go back and forth on that exact thing. Do you just walk away and say, well, this person is so down their rabbit hole that, you know, I'm not going to convince them? Or do you, and personally, I think, you know, as a journalist, you know, your job is to continue to tell that story and work that beat until something resonates with someone. And, you know, putting a human face on a story, you would hope that that would work all the time, but it doesn't, unfortunately.
Right, yeah.
We could see a million examples of that. But, you know, it's how do you, and I think it might even go deeper than a journalist's job in a way, I think, and perhaps it falls a little bit more on the community. How do you build sympathy and empathy?
Right.
So that when people do read an article and see something on the news, they say, oh, wow, I should care about this.
Right.
So I mean, to sum it up, I think I wish journalists could convince everyone. I don't think that they ever will, but we have got to figure out this lack of empathy, and this lack of willingness to understand another person's perspective.
Well, it seems like you've become very patient with your craft, and that you have sort of made your peace with the inherent dissonance that's always going to be there between where the story is and where you need to meet somebody to really change their mind. Right. There's always going to be that gap to some extent with some people all the time. Do you ever get discouraged?
I think right now it's an amazing time to be a journalist. And by saying it's an amazing time, it's the most frustrating of times because yes, from an audience perspective, you have people that vilify and truly hate journalists. How did I pick a profession that is actually hated?
Right, like right.
That was not the intention of it.
Well, people don't like the idea of having to have their minds changed.
Right.
And that's right. And that's not a journalist's fault.
Right.
That's just,
I mean, it's hard to admit bias or the need to change, or it's hard for humans. I understand that.
Especially in a culture that tells you, you know, you're entitled to whatever damn thing you want, right? Because freedom.
Right.
Yeah, right. Think whatever the hell you want, man. This is America. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, there are some things that are causing harm to our society, to others, and to our planet because person X, Y, and Z refuses to change their damn mind.
Right.
Right.
Right. Oh, yes. Preach.
So, hey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to like get off.
Oh, no.
On my own little soapbox, but
no, that's a perfect.
But so you're vilified.
Yes. it's, you know, you're just truly hated. But then on the other hand, journalists, the amazing thing is that journalism now is, and of course there's going to be some newspaper people who disagree with me, but journalism is, whether it's broadcast or, you know, online, it's all reliant on technology, which is fantastic. And it means that we can reach everybody and close to everybody, which should be really great and exciting. But at the same time, when you have access to all the information, going back to our point earlier, people can pick their own reality now. Right. And I think that makes it difficult as a journalist. And it's difficult for outlets and individual journalists to make a mark, because you do have to think about it from a business perspective. Okay. Who else is chasing this story? Who else is working on this story?
Yeah.
Who, if everyone's putting out the same story, how are we going to get someone to read this one?
Right. You are up against the machine.
Yeah.
The great.
It is a true.
Yeah. It is. It
algorithmic.
Yeah. I mean, it can be depressing at times. I'm not a journalist. I do love writing. I write for myself and I write creatively at times, but I could never get into the profession of writing nonfiction, especially as a journalist, because I do get disheartened very easily. I work very hard to keep a somewhat romantic view of the world just to keep myself from going insane, even though I know the very cynical reality behind all of it as well. I can play kind of both sides of that coin, but to lighten things up, I guess, you know, because I'm getting a little depressed thinking about just like
go into the what is the yeah, future just like of how journalism kind of
how you know, screwed we really are right now. I mean, so let's talk about the difference between nonfiction writing and fiction writing, because write fiction as well.
Yes.
And your main type of writing is screenplay and film.
Yes,
right?
Correct.
So why, I guess, and how much of your creative output is spent writing screenplays and writing for film?
Yeah. And so, yes. So I have always loved film as a medium. And I think that is growing up, quote unquote, in the industry in LA.
Right.
That was just something that I knew and I grew up with. And you know, the first thing that I got to do was, you know, create YouTube like my first paycheck, I guess, was like creating YouTube content in college. And I was like, this is awesome. Film is so cool.
Yeah.
I can be paid to make this. And I, you know, I just fell in love with it, from the beginning. I've been fortunate, and then also I think it is just a matter of people who are in the creative field. I've touched a lot of different aspects of filmmaking. You know, I've done the PA, which is, you know, production assistant,
right,
lugging around lights, and I've done the background extra, sitting in a tent for 12 hours to walk across a stage.
Right.
You know, I've worked in the editing, you know, editing bays with people who, you know, so I've gotten to see all the different aspects of film. And for me, film, there's a lot of creative outlets that are community driven, but I have yet to find one that is so wonderful as film. It takes a village. It takes creative people. It takes technical people. It takes people that are, you know, wonderful with logistics, just to get an entire village of people to do something.
Right.
And so that aspect of film has always been the most interesting to me. And you know, when a screenplay, when I think about, when I write something, this could, you know, when you're working on a film, this could be 200 people or more working on this singular story.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what really drew me to filmmaking. And I've been fortunate enough to do some indie films. I've worked on sets for bigger films, knowing that I, you know, learning along the way, never want to do production again, probably.
Really?
It's a different beast.
Yeah.
But I think all of those moments of being part of all the different aspects of filmmaking, you know, made me fall in love with the creative process more and more. And we can kind of talk about how that was different when I switched up to playwriting, but
yeah, I'd love to.
But yes, so that's where my filmmaking comes from, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
My thought process.
When did you start writing screenplays? Has this been kind of a long trajectory for you to get to this point, or is it something fairly recent that you actually started writing creatively for the screen?
So I started writing my first screenplay in high school. I remember sitting down and being like, what can I write that will be filmed?
Right.
And, you know, I continued dabbling with it throughout college and since then. And it's really, it's a cool process because it forces you to really think about and understand people.
Mm-hmm.
So when you are writing, unlike if you're writing, you know, any other sort of, you know, long form piece, when you're doing your research for a screenplay or a play, you really have to study people. How do they say things? How would this character, you know, mold in this situation? What would they be doing? And so, you know, also just being fascinated with people and wanting to be like, how would I make this character come alive? And what in my real world could I start emulating that I'm interested in?
What were you watching growing up? Because with both your parents being very creative people, your mom being in film, I imagine there was a push to expand the, you know, horizons of what you were viewing beyond just whatever the current blockbuster was, right? I mean, were you watching... I've always been drawn to film, and then I always kind of went behind my parents' back and watched all of like the R-rated films that I shouldn't have been watching when I was, you know, 11 years old, watching right. Scarface or Taxi Driver or Midnight Express or
all the great,
a lot of these like really kind of fucked up movies for a kid to be watching, but like brilliant cinema.
Right.
Right. Well, so what were you watching and what are you watching now? Like what still kind of lights that creative fire for you, and what did when you were young?
Yeah. You know, growing up, it was a lot of movies and not a lot of TV.
Mm-hmm.
Which was great. And a lot of it was sitting down and really, really digesting a film, I guess, and saying like, okay, what is this about? And, you know, I growing up loved spy movies. So like I probably watched, you know, all of the Bourne movies, all, you know, Manchurian Candidate, like,
Are you a Bond fan?
Oh, huge Bond fan. That's actually, slightly what my play was based on was, yes.
What's your favorite Bond film? What's your favorite Bond actor? I'm a huge Bond person as well.
Ooh, how do you pick one? I would have to say, even though it's a modern one, Skyfall.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. I think it just comes together so well. And I think, yes, when you get... Now, I mean, really all of them get into the psyche of exploring what it would mean to be a spy and all of that. But I think that one particularly resonated.
Well, a very specific type of spy, too. It's not just a spy. It's a spy who has very kind of specific and easily exposed vulnerabilities.
Right.
Who's
right.
At the same time, like this almost... killing machine, but on the other hand, very much so human.
It's such a wonderful exploration of character development.
Yeah.
Where you think like, yes, this person is not, you know, yes, is not invincible. This person has
right.
huge flaws.
Yeah. And very relevant flaws to the mass audience.
Yes.
I mean, here's someone who struggles with, I mean, just drinking, women,
Every vice that
right.
people deal with on a day to day.
Right, right. I mean, anyway, I don't want to get too deep down the Bond hole, but I have been thinking a lot about Bond because a couple weeks ago was Bond Week, I think, at the Plaza Theater.
Oh,
and
yes,
they had
yes.
the Bond Lotus like replica sitting outside
and it
the
was,
theater, which was epic. But
also,
yeah.
The Plaza Theater, just a wonderful place.
I've never been. Atlanta. Everyone listening to this podcast is going to shoot me, and they're going to stop listening after this episode. But
We'll go.
never been to the Plaza Theater. Sadly, I live like right down the street
right,
from me.
Right, right. Well, yes, you need to find a time to go. But, So I very much grew up in watching film from a perspective of critiquing the characters and critiquing the plot. And that sounds like we weren't sitting around, you know, like pausing it and right. saying like, okay, well, what should they have done differently or whatever? But I think really experiencing film as a true art form, and I think that was something that was really kind of hammered into me.
Yeah,
that it is a you know, of course, it's a business; it employs tons of people, but it's an all-encompassing art form, and so having my mom talk about, okay, well, think about the music that's coming in here. Think about the sound here. You know, you really start thinking about film from every angle.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think it's so cool that you grew up in that environment. And you grew up in LA, which at the time was it for movies in the United States. I mean, it was pretty much like that was it. And kind of. Right. I mean, it was the biggest
center
for film in the U.S.
Yes. But I also witnessed, you know, the writer's strike that went on and that took a lot of film out.
Yeah.
And so seeing the business side of it, too, it is not just all La La Land
right.
actors on the street and things. But seeing and, you know, I... Really, you know, it was really in high school, growing up and having friends, you know, and family friends and everyone really struggle when the shift started happening. You know, we witnessed the shift start happening from saying all film is made in LA to, oh, now films in Georgia, films right. in New Mexico, films in Toronto.
Right. Right.
So yes. I mean, which I guess fortunately or unfortunately came to Atlanta, so it worked out.
It followed you here. You brought it with you.
But it was, you know, LA is, it still holds that spot as film capital. But we're seeing that change, and that is for political reasons, for economic reasons, but also the fact that there's talented filmmakers and creatives elsewhere.
Yeah. And it's been, I mean, amazing for our economy.
Oh, yeah.
For film to come here in what is now called Yollywood.
And, good old Yollywood.
And it's, I think it's fantastic to be able to, you know, as a born and bred Atlantan, kind of brag about my city a little bit in this regard, that we are shooting a lot of
more
incredible film here. I was just in Spain. And there were Stranger Things posters and ads up everywhere. And I'm like, that was film in my backyard, you know? It feels good that film is here.
Oh, yeah.
And you have been involved in film here as well outside of writing, which is, I want to kind of get into how we're now moving into micro theater.
Yeah.
You started something called Film Pitch.
Yes, yes.
Right? So it's at a year old now.
Yes.
So congratulations.
Thank you. Incredible. Everyone should come to our, yes, August will be our year anniversary. So
August when? Give me a date.
Last week of August, August 28th. So we need, you know, yes, everyone should come. You should come and see what it's all about. But Film Pitch has been one of the coolest things to see expand in this city. And, you know, I'll talk about it from my perspective, and then I will give you another suggestion for a guest you should definitely have, who
Perfect.
Is, someone who I've worked with for 10 years now, on tons of creative projects and films and everything. But yeah, so Film Pitch was born out of this idea that Georgia, Atlanta, whatever, has a plethora of amazing creative talent. And we do not do enough to support, as a city, as a state, we support the Avengers. We support Stranger Things. We have, you know, we support the Hollywood productions. But at the end of the day, those productions pack up and go back west. We don't do enough as a city to support local filmmakers. And so Steven Bieler, who is, you know, the true mastermind behind Film Pitch ATL, said, you know, what if we got people in the room and started talking about indie film in a new and innovative way? And for indie filmmakers, it's about how do you tell the story of your film when you are trying to get funding, you're trying to get everything off the ground. It's a slog. What can we do to connect filmmakers with people that can make a difference, whether that's people who are investing in film or want to invest in film or are simply just interested in supporting local talent. So yes, that's how Film Pitch was born. We've been fortunate enough that people became really excited about it. And we've had people come and we've sold out. I think we've sold out all but one early on, one of them. But since then we've had to, we're running out of space, which is a great problem to have.
That's incredible. Where's your space now?
So we're at Pond City Market.
Okay.
So we host it there every month, and it is, you know, a great central gathering point for people.
Yeah.
For sure. And to be able to say, you know, you're an up and coming filmmaker. You know, how do you get your story out there? And you know, we borrowed a page from the tech industry, really, because when you talk to a founder of an app or, you know, some person, they have their elevator pitch. They know exactly how much money they need. They know how to sell you, as they should.
Right.
And you know, they, you know, obviously they're not just in Silicon Valley, but they're doing their thing in the Valley, and they're very good at selling.
Right.
Indie filmmakers are not.
Creatives, I find,
are not. Creatives are not,
yes. That's one of the biggest things that my background is in business. I mean, I am a creative person, but seeing that gap, you know, just talking to people and immersing myself more in the creative community, there is so much more we could all be doing.
Oh, yeah.
If we just had a little bit more exposure to, like, how to sell our shit. Like, we
this is a business. Yeah,
right, exactly. Yeah. So I couldn't agree more. There needs to be more opportunities to pitch and sell well and appropriately. And yeah.
And we need people like you who have that business savviness to come over into the creative space and be in the creative space and say, these two things are not separate.
Not at all. Not at all. Nothing, you know, to your point about a film production, it takes a village. Including bankers, financiers, bookkeepers, you know, all sorts of logistics and financiers to make
anything. Gotta keep the lights on.
Yeah, right. And so how is Film Pitch practically doing that? So walk me through what a session or what a Film Pitch gathering looks like.
Yeah, so every month we have four or five filmmakers who we select and we say, hey, we want to hear your story. And we set it up very much like a pitch competition, quote unquote, but there's not a competition at the end. It's very much about giving access to, or giving people accessibility and the ability to tell their story. And the audience comes in, you know, there's networking opportunities for people to say, like, okay, you know, people who are coming here clearly are into film, are in the industry, or interested in the industry. And if you're a filmmaker, you stand up and you have 5 minutes to tell people your story. And that includes, you know, how far along you are in production. We've had people pitch ideas where they've gone up there with mood boards and said, you know, I want to do a country western. Here's how it's different. Here's kind of the mood I'm going for. Great. That's sometimes enough.
Right.
We have other people who have shot an entire pilot season and are now saying, yeah, I need money to distribute this now.
Interesting. Okay.
So these are filmmakers in various stages of the creative process who need something from the community.
So who's in the room? Are we looking for people who are in these larger studios who have connections, people who just have fat wallets looking to contribute?
You know, in an ideal world, and when we first started out, we were like, we're going to get all the big people that can invest and who are investing in something else right now, and we're going to convince them they should invest in local indie film.
Right.
You know, there are investors who come, and that's wonderful. We also find that it is people who are in the film industry who are coming, who are able to give really wonderful insight and positive, you know, constructive feedback on the idea that they're going with. So it becomes this kind of creative, whiteboarding session in a way for some people,
right,
who say,
right,
like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. And sometimes that's working on storyline. Sometimes that gets into the budget. People saying, okay, you know, that's a great story idea. Do you really need a rocket ship? Because that's going to be expensive.
Right.
What if you rewrote this and cut that from the budget?
Right.
You might be able to do this for half the cost,
yeah,
or so.
Yeah.
So it's grown into this really interesting and organic indie film community of people who come every month. And this probably sounds very corny, but it becomes this celebration of local artists and,
right,
local filmmakers who, you know, it's hard to get up there in front of 200 people you don't know. And,
wow, it's that many people.
Yeah, yeah.
That's wild. That's
so
awesome.
It's,
okay.
It's a packed house.
That's fantastic. Well, I'll definitely be at the next one.
You have to be. You,
yeah,
have to be. And, you know, it's hard to get up there. And as you mentioned, like, creatives have a hard time selling.
Right.
And this is about getting people who have an idea and a creative idea up in front of people and saying, hey, let's, you know, this is my idea. It is different and unique because XYZ.
Yeah.
And this is why this story needs to be told. And so hopefully it's getting filmmakers out of their comfort zone, you know, and hopefully it's exposing people in Atlanta to truly wonderful indie filmmakers. You know, because we're, for however long Hollywood is going to be here, which is a political conversation now,
oh,
more,
yeah,
than anything.
Oh yeah.
We're always going to have quality filmmakers here. So even if quote unquote Hollywood goes away from here, we have to support our local filmmakers.
I couldn't agree more. What has been a success story, if there's like one that comes to mind? Like, what have you ever left one of these and been like, yes, like, this is why we did this?
Yes. Oh gosh. So early on there was a film, that we've had a couple of documentaries that have come through, which has been really great. And you know, documentaries kind of pull at my heartstring because, you know, it's one of my favorite mediums. So seeing a couple of documentaries come through, I think the one time that I was like, this is exciting, I'm glad this is happening, is when we had five completely different pitches. We had someone pitch a reality TV show concept, which at first I was like, okay, this is not real. But it was interesting and different.
Right.
We had someone who had like a horror film, someone who did an episodic about the opioid crisis, and walking out of there and saying, we were able to present the audience with five completely different takes on film.
Yeah. Very cool.
Is super exciting.
Yeah. I love that. I'm sorry I haven't been to one. I will definitely be at this next one. August 28th. Yeah?
Let me double.
Let's confirm.
Double check.
Let's confirm. We'll mention it again at the end of the episode, and I'll probably mention it at the intro as well.
It is... Let me just double check. Yes, August. Let me see if it's up here already. Film Pitch ATL. We can also plug if you know any other spaces that hold more than 200 people.
We'll talk offline because I might.
Yes, August 28th.
Okay, perfect. Is it a Friday?
Wednesday.
Wednesday, okay.
It's a Wednesday.
Wednesday, August 28th.
6 to 9.
Be at Film Pitch ATL. They can find out info online, I'm assuming, at Film Pitch ATL.
Yep, Film Pitch ATL. You can type that in. You'll find it. You can go... The company organization that's sponsoring it is called Roll Call.
Okay.
R-O-L-E Call.
Good to know.
All of the information is on those. But we would love more people to come out if you're interested in filmmaking. If you're just interested in supporting Atlanta creatives, that's right. Really enough of a pull.
Yeah. And if you're listening to the show, hopefully you are. But we'll plug it again just to make sure everyone knows before we wrap up. But Film Pitch, and again, congrats on it, a year, but led into micro theater.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
So tell me about how, because now we're coming full circle. How did Film Pitch and all of your background in writing, both creatively and not, lead to Atlanta Micro Theater? What is the origin story?
Yes, yes. So the origin story is similar to how Film Pitch came about in a way. It came from a conversation I had with Steven Beeler, who is the founder of Film Pitch, and he's been my, partner in crime for so many different creative things. And we had gotten Film Pitch off the ground, and we were talking about how, both of us are true Atlantans, in that, we're not from the city, but we're here now, and we love this space. And we were talking about how, okay, what do you do on a Friday night in Atlanta? You go out to eat, you go out to drink, and you go hang out with friends.
That's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I am by no means knocking the wonderful bar scene and restaurant scene, because we have fantastic places to go that I frequent often. Amazing chefs, all of that. But it gets old after a while.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how, in order to access art so often, it's, I have to buy an $100 ticket to the Fox Theater to see a full production
right.
of something, which is great, but that's not an every week. That's not something you can easily access. And for many people and families, that's a true luxury.
Right.
And I, for one, don't think art, I think art is, should be accessed by everyone. And we started realizing, even going to the movies for some people, that's hard. That's an expense.
Right.
So we said, so we kind of had these two ideas. Okay, what else is there to do but walk the Beltline and eat and drink? And why is art and culture so inaccessible mm-hmm. to people?
Mm-hmm.
We said, after mulling those two ideas over, we thought, well, there's a way we could do this. And we'd seen models of this, in Miami, and we said, if at some point, if you don't like something, change it. And this was our answer.
Got it.
We said, we want to make art and culture accessible. We want it to be something that's part of daily life or weekend life, I guess.
Right.
That someone can say, I want a touch of art and culture in between my dinner and my after dinner drinks. And so that's what we hope to bring to people with micro theater, to make it accessible right on the Beltline where some people are already hanging out, inexpensive. You're not shelling out a lot of money to come see local, talent. And, from the flip side, if you're a creative, we wanted to, really say, there are actors who want to act. There are writers who want to write. let's give them the stage and see what happens.
That's absolutely, I think, the most important thing is just putting people in front of other people. That's what's missing in art. That's what, I mean, that's what we're trying to do with Show ATL, right? Is it's out there in our city, right? It's, we are not in a New York. We are not in a London or a Paris where it's everywhere. You just walk down the street and boom. I mean, you'd have a hard time not finding
hit in the face with it.
Talent, art, actors, musicians, whatever. But it's there.
Oh, we have just brilliant creatives here. And yes, it's about giving them the audience.
Right, right. So Micro Theater is a production by yourself as well as other writers?
Yes. So for this first one, we really did have to base it on the space that we found. So
right.
At the bottom of Telephone Factory Lofts. And we realized we had space for two plays to run simultaneously. So we had another playwright who did a play with four actors.
Okay.
And then I wrote a play or adopted a play that I'd been I adopted a screenplay that I was working on to make it a play. And then I performed in the other kind of cozy little room in the back.
That's cool.
Yes.
Okay. So you were in a play as well?
No.
Okay.
I was
okay.
Yeah. I wrote and directed, and we had four actors.
Got it. Okay. So four a piece you guys had for the two productions.
Four by four.
Okay. And this is something that it was run five times, one night. What is the trajectory? I assume it went very well, and there's going to be another one, hopefully.
So it was, talk about a learning experience. You know, a couple weeks before, we were like, are we going to be able to do this?
Right.
Like, I had never casted something for live theater, which is a total different beast. Where I was like, we had to make sure that, timing was going to work out. And, we weren't sure, okay, were we really going to get enough foot traffic, enough people interested? And we kind of had the opposite problem in that we sold out every show was sold out.
That's incredible.
And
congratulations. Seriously.
Thank you.
That's incredible for a first run.
I was shocked in a way. But I think that also shows that people in Atlanta want art and culture that's accessible, and they want to support it. We ended up having to find extra folding chairs and put people in the back. I think most creatives and most people that are starting off, initially I was like, I'm going to have my friends sit in five different shows so that it looks full.
Right.
And I was like, sorry, I don't have extra tickets to give you.
that is a great problem to have.
So yes, I'm excited. And what I think is awesome too is that, the opportunity to showcase my writing and my directing was obviously very exciting, but we've had people come, write us and already submit plays and saying, hey, I'm a writer. I'm a playwright.
Yeah.
I want to do this. Like, here's my play. So I think it has, it has legs, it has an audience, and it has people who want to showcase their art in that way. So I foresee this continuing.
No second date quite yet.
No second date quite yet.
Okay.
We're working on it. I wanted to have something to say definitively.
Right. Yeah.
But I will keep you posted as we figure it out. We're working through space opportunities and options. But it's been really cool to the feedback of people saying, I've not seen something like this in Atlanta. Thank you for putting this on.
Right. I think that's fantastic. I am looking forward to when the next date is announced.
Yes. Absolutely.
And we will definitely publicize it on this program and through our social media and everything. But what was, you mentioned the challenge of adapting a screenplay to a one act, production for theater.
Yes.
What was that process like for you? You mentioned as well how much space played a part.
Yes.
Actually identifying the space and how the space would work with something that you had written. So was it space first, and then you found something that, that you had wanted to perform on the stage, and then you adapted it? Or how did that process work?
It was a little bit of both, and I think that's speaks to the creative process and kind of how that has to be. So I had written, or I wrote a screenplay that really happened to be centralized on four characters, which was, you know, I had been writing this for a long time. Nothing had really happened with it. It was my, you know, my pet project for a little bit, where I just, you know, when you have time, I was just working on this screenplay.
Right.
And had been adapting it for a couple of years, never hadn't even really thought about doing anything with it other than saying, this is for fun. When the opportunity for micro theater came, and I saw the space, it very much felt, you walked in and I thought, oh, I could make this a speakeasy. This, it has this very, you know, industrial kind of hidden, very hidden, down this long corridor. And I thought, okay, this space I can envision as a speakeasy. And I knew that the screenplay that I had written, it opens in a bar speakeasy.
Okay.
And so I thought, okay, maybe this will be something.
Right.
So from there I thought, okay, let me see if I can get that first act down into a succinct one part story.
Right.
Can I introduce characters? Can I create drama? And can I set some sort of resolution in 15 minutes?
Incredibly challenging.
Incredibly challenging, especially when I'd been developing these characters for years. And yeah. I was like, no, but you have to, they have to go through this change. And I've, you know, I've developed them out and this story takes place over months and multiple locations. So that was challenge number one, was just saying, can I make this just a single package to present? Then came the second challenge, which I think anyone who does any sort of theater will laugh and be like, well, of course it would be different. you know, I had casted for film, and, you know, I know kind of what that looks like to work with film actors.
Right.
Stage acting is very different. The first time we did a run through, and we got these actors that I just adored, and, you know, I felt like they could do these characters justice. And the first time we did a table read, I just cringed because I was like, oh, that sounds awful.
Really?
Coming out of someone else's mouth in a theater production.
Right.
You know, the nice thing, and also the thing that I realized made me a little lazy in my writing, is that I wrote it with the intention of it being on film. And in film, it's a little more forgiving in that you can cut. you can change the angle of someone. You can, you know, dramatically go into and zoom into someone's face when you need a certain reaction.
Right, right.
In a play, everything is on display at all times. There is no room for error. And having, you know, lines that I was like, oh, we'll be fine. We'll just, you know, cut where we need. Right. Oh no, you need to tell them this is exactly where you come in. this is exactly how I need you to deliver this line every time. Was a fun challenge as a director to say, okay, you know, even thinking about, oh, we're in a speakeasy. I can't just have you clinking glasses all around because that's going to be loud.
Right, right.
And distracting to the audience.
That's interesting. I just, so many intricacies that I don't even really want to think about. It just sounds so stressful to put it all together, all of these moving parts. But it's also very beautiful in the way that you get to see in sometimes very painful detail, your creative work come to light.
Yes. And, you know, as a, when you're a writer and a director together, it's like the best and the worst experience, because you wrote something, and writing is so intimate, and you're like, this is exactly, you know, you have a picture of how it will be.
Right.
And then you have to put on your director hat and say, well, this is what we're working with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Put the ideas, you know, say that was great. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. This is what we got.
This is what we got. This is practically what we're going to work with.
Right.
And the painful process of, you know, say, well, that line doesn't work anymore.
Right. Yeah. So going forward, you, a lot of takeaways, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And do you feel better about a round two? I mean, do you feel a little more comfortable in your own skin as a theater director?
I do. I would love to do it again.
Yeah.
And I think as a writer and or director, understanding more about how that works and writing for a live audience.
Right.
I understand that a bit more. And you know, and I think you need to do everything once and make it very handmade, and then say, all right, what can I learn from and grow from as a creative?
Right.
And bring that to the next one. So yeah, I'm excited to try it again. I think it, there's the moment of being like, okay, my work was out there in the world, in a medium, on a platform that I'm not 100% familiar with.
Yeah. But you did it.
So yes, there's a little bit of like, oh, okay, we've taken off in that direction a little bit, which is exciting. And I think, for writers in any platform, it's a good exercise. If you, whether you're a journalist or a poet or, you know, whatever, writing in a different medium or genre, it makes you think more about your writing.
Mm.
And so I would highly encourage that just as an exercise for any writers.
Yeah. I am petrified of having anything that I write out into the world. I would love to publish something someday.
Well, yeah,
But it is a massive piece of your soul that you're putting out and kind of bearing to the world and saying, judge this how you will, right? This is, you know, this is on display for you, whatever you think of it. It's no longer my role to tell my story in an unadulterated way. It is your story, and you make of it what you will as well as the audience. And that's tough. And
it's
so
hard.
I commend you for that.
But, it's part of the creative process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
Well, that's brilliant. For the sake of time, I do want to ask you about one other thing, which is traveling.
Yes.
We've traveled together, once, twice, how many times?
We did Lisbon.
Yes. And was that it?
Have we done anywhere else?
That might've been it. Cause that
okay, well, we'll need to plan a trip.
Yeah. I did Paris with Patrick and them.
Okay. Okay.
Lisbon,
planning another trip.
Right. But you are, I am a lover of travel and culture, and so are you, and
we've gotten to talk about that a lot.
Yeah, and you've been fortunate to travel a lot as well. And I guess I'm wondering, what do you take from traveling and seeing the world that, and I'm not asking about, there is something I want to ask you about that is like a tangible thing that comes from traveling, but with regards to just writing and inspiration, how does the world and you moving about it, how does that influence you? Do you write a lot on the road?
Oh, yes. So that is where I will spend days at a coffee shop, wherever I'm at. You know, obviously I love sightseeing and walking about, but there's something really invigorating as a writer to just sit down in a place you don't know.
Mm.
And you have to take in the people and the sights and the sounds. Because when you're out of your comfort zone, that's when you really start to discover some interesting, new ideas.
Right.
And you're kind of forced to grapple with different perspectives and kind of even warring ideas in your mind about how something should be and how something is.
Right.
Which for me is how travel has been just a really like wonderful lens with which to like start a new writing process or project.
What's been one memorable place that sticks out to you as a place that drew a lot of inspiration and that was powerful to you as a creative?
Yes, yes. So this would be the one, and it's, you know, for me, and it was important and influential in a couple of different ways, but going to Sarajevo was this, and really the Balkans in general, was mm-hmm. this really creative trip for me.
Yeah.
As a lover of history, Sarajevo is, of course, a place that I had to go.
Right.
It sounds a little weird to be like, a lover of World War One and World War Two is not the right phrase, but like having an interest in these wars,
sure, yeah.
and how they unfolded. It was a place that I had to go. And, you know, I remember so vividly sitting on a train between Belgrade and Sarajevo. And it's this old, it has not been renovated since like, this was like, Yugoslavia.
It's oh wow! Like okay,
old,
right.
awful train, and it's like an overnight train, and long story short, this has a point to writing that I'll get to. But we were going, and I was with one of my dear friends, and we got on this train, which God knows how we did it.
Right.
We did not speak the language. It was awful. We made it though. And we get on the train, and we, in a moment of us not really having done our homework, we did not realize that, when we crossed borders,
right.
the alphabet was going to change to Cyrillic.
Okay.
So we had known what stop we needed to get off at, where we needed to transfer, and that all went out the window
God.
We were like, well, I don't know what that sign says, so I can't even fake it
yeah.
right now.
Right.
And that was one of the, I've had a lot of moments that were, stressful traveling. And that was by no means like the most stressful, but it made me really appreciate just how beautiful, just even reading or looking at language really is. And when
right.
you go around and think, it really, the rest of the trip, I was like, okay, well, I want to understand what that sign says. I'll never speak that, I'll never speak Serbo-Croatian.
Right.
Maybe. assume not. But I, I need to get out of my bubble. I
right.
need to start understanding this language and these signs to be able to travel and explore. And that on that trip, I just spent so much of my time writing. Probably most of my trip was
right.
just writing. And so I would say that was like an inspirational moment for me that kind of clicked.
I'm glad I asked that question, because that's not really a place I was expecting, nor a story that I was expecting. So, I mean, but it's testament to, I'm the same way. I get very inspired when I'm traveling, and it's a testament to just, you never know where you're going to be. And sometimes it is those very unusual,
stressful moments
that like kind of light that fire.
Yes.
Yeah. Last thing I want to get you out of here, 'cause I know we've been going, we've been having an awesome conversation.
Yeah.
But random fun fact that you shared with me, which is not completely off topic, but somewhat off topic, but just something I wanted to touch on out of personal curiosity. And it is something that you have been collecting. You mentioned that you
yes.
have been collecting these porcelain eggs.
Is yes. it
decoupage? Am I
yes.
saying that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Which
I have no idea what the hell these things are, which is just very uncultured of me. I know.
No, this is, yes. I was like, what is something that most people don't know?
Yeah. This is not really, this is a bit off topic, to be honest, like at this point, but I just want to know, and I think it'd be just like a fun thing to leave people with before we wrap up.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I, I have an interesting collection, I guess, in that if you've ever traveled around or seen these, they're just colorful Easter eggs, essentially. But they, you know, and they're ornately decorated. Some of them are carved out. Some of them, you know, represent the kind of areas that they're from. And it was something I believe my grandmother started collecting, or someone of a previous generation.
Right.
And that got passed down to my mom. And then my mom continued to collect these eggs wherever she went. And for whatever reason, I just became really fascinated by them, and seeing just this entire, you know, I have a big collection of them now, right. From around the world. And it's so random, but it's cool to see one piece of art that you can find in a ton of places. You know, I have one from Turkey. I have one from Argentina, and all over. And to say, like, this is something that has been adopted around the world in this very interesting, unique way, and each one kind of represents that region of the world.
Right.
It's a little cooler than a magnet, maybe, that some people collect.
I think so.
But, and, you know, it's cool because I look at them and, you know, they're, well, I guess they're at my parents' house, so I have not taken them into my apartment. But, you know, I know where most of them come from, but there's some that are from, you know, decades and decades ago. But it's cool to see them all together as this interesting kind of like way to remember all of your travels.
Yeah. And you wrote to me that you were asking questions about their origins before you had ever started traveling yourself. And that kind of lit this creativity in you to want to explore the world and to tell the stories behind these things that you were brought up with.
Yes. You know, there's one egg that's from the USSR, of course, now very old. And I remember, you know, asking questions about, well, what do you mean that country doesn't exist anymore?
Right.
You know, why was it so difficult for you to get that egg?
Yeah.
When, you know, as an American traveling back over there. So, you know, I do remember have very specific memories of being like, what are these places? What are these far off places that I don't know about? And you know, I kind of got interested in the world through that. And now it's just a way to kind of continue this cool tradition, and have something to bring back from wherever I go.
Yeah. There's too many stories out there that need to be told that are not being told, but at the same time, it's an absolute joy to me, at least, to be able to go out and live stories and tell stories and have stories both that I share and stories that are just kind of now a part of me as a person that I've taken in places I go and things I do. So thank you for telling stories.
Thank you for telling stories.
And all of the ways that you tell them. You're a blessing to our city, and I'm really happy that you're my friend.
Thank you. Likewise. And you're doing an amazing thing for the city as well, showcasing some, you know, people from all different walks of life and people that are making the city great. So you're making the city great. And, I'm really honored to be here, but most importantly to, you know, have you as a friend and have these great conversations.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun. I hope to do it again. I want to get you out of here because we've been here a while and I know it's a weekday, but before we wrap up, tell everyone of all the wonderful things that you're doing, where people can learn more about them, about micro theater, about film pitch, about anything else that you're working on personally. Where can people look all these things up?
Yeah. So you, for film pitch and micro theater, you can head to the website rollcall.co. So rollcall.co. Mm-hmm. That's where we're kind of keeping all of these larger projects.
Okay.
Underneath. And so you can find those there. And then my personal writing is on my website, myalisa.com. There's a lot of extra letters in there, but once you find it, it's okay.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'll make sure to plug it as well in the intro to this show. And the next The next film pitch, again, is Wednesday, August 28th.
We'll see you all there.
Everyone should go to that. And then the next micro theater, to be determined, but there will be another one, and we'll let everyone know when that is.
Absolutely. And you should all be there as well.
Yeah. Maya Ellinger, teller of stories, both fiction, nonfiction, traveler, all around awesome, awesome person. Thank you so much for coming onto the Show ATL podcast.
It's been awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Show ATL podcast, the podcast where we seek to find and highlight Atlanta creatives and creators and tell the stories of the people and organizations making amazing things in our city. I am your host, Parsa Benamory. Our show today was produced by Mr. Coleman Erkins with help from myself and Corrigan Nolan. Our music is produced by Relax with Alex. Want to thank all of the guests who come onto this program and tell their amazing stories with us and share with us, as well as to our wonderful listeners who continue to support us week in and week out. If you love this episode, if you love this show as a whole, if you like Show ATL and consider it something that you listen to frequently, please consider giving us a 5-star rating or a nice review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever else you use to listen to your podcasts. Please consider supporting us if you care to. Again, we're a small team working to put together this show for you every week. And we have a Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/showATL. You can give a one-time donation or a recurring donation. All funds will be used to make this show better and better and better for you. So we would greatly appreciate that. Thank you again for listening. Thank you again for supporting us. Thank you again for being a part of the conversation that we continue to have day in and day out to make our city a better place, a more creative place. We will catch you next time. Thank you. Goodbye.